good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, February the 15th, day after Valentine's Day, 2018, 2:15:18, 15 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program, and we have got a very interesting show today. I want to tell you what's coming up next hour, though, just so you'll stay tuned during our 1 o'clock break. Next hour, we're going to be joined via telephone by Joey DiOria. Now, you might not recognize that name, but he was Bozo the Clown on WGN Radio for all those years. He's currently a voice actor out in Hollywood, been in a lot of movies, so we'll talk to Joey DiOria next hour. And do want to give you a heads up. Somebody stopped by this morning and let us know that there's a food pantry tonight at the Victory Center Church on East Fairground Street, 5 to 6:30 p.m. All you need is an ID to show you are from Marion. 5 to 6:30 tonight, Victory Center Church, East Fairground Street, food pantry tonight. So don't forget that. Now, this hour is going to be a lot of fun because we are going to talk with a gentleman who made news last week. He's been on with us before, but last week the news was he is retiring after 30 years on the bench here in Marion, Judge William Finnegan. Judge Finnegan, how are you?
Doing real fine today, Scott.
Why are you retiring?
Well, as you stated, by the time my term ends up January 1st next year, it'll be 30 years that I've served as a judge. I'm third longest serving judge in Marion County history. And although I'm fairly young for retiring as a judge at age 63, 30 years is a pretty solid long time. And thought I might kick back a little bit.
Was it a hard choice to make?
No, not really. I really didn't have a lot of examples as to the appropriate retirement age when I was growing up, because my dad died when I was 8, and both my grandfathers died early. And so I used my mom as an example, and she retired at age 60. And I figured, well, end of the term after I turn 60, that's where I'll retire.
What do you plan to do when you take this retirement?
Well, there's a few things. For one thing, I won't be completely out of the judge gig because as a retired judge, I can take visiting judge status and be appointed by the Supreme Court on various cases or to various courts around the state. And because I did 14 years at common pleas courts, I can do common pleas cases. Because I did 16 years at municipal court, I can be assigned to municipal courts too. So there's a lot of courts I can be assigned to. And it can be for a particular case that I'm just assigned for the one case, or it could be if the judge is knocked out because of physical problems. Like 5 years ago, I had cancer, and I was knocked out of commission for a total of like 3 months. They brought in visiting judges from Hardin County, retired visiting judges, to do the work. So I'll be sort of on the other side, filling in for those judges who might be ill or for other reasons can't handle their court operations.
So you still would like to stay involved?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, I love the law.
Yeah. What do you love about the law?
Oh, there's a lot of things. I love trying to get the right legal issues. I love legal research. You're fully engaged mentally. You have to figure out, read the people. Figure out what the best approach is to take care of the things and make things better. The appropriate sentence if they did something wrong. It's very mentally engaging, and I like that.
You talked about your mother and your father. What was your childhood like? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Lancaster. Funny thing, my birth certificate... my address is listed as the Boys Industrial School, which for the younger listeners and such was the big house for juveniles in the Ohio State system. That's where they went, was the Boys Industrial School. Now, why it was on my birth certificate, my father taught at the Reform School there, and my mother was a house mother there. So we lived in one of the cottages with some of the people there. And as my mother liked to say, murderers used to babysit me. So, and that was true. So So, but I don't remember it. We moved before I turned two. Then I moved up to Kent, Ohio, up in the northeast part of the state. Lived a pretty pretty middle-class existence. And like I say, my dad died when I was eight, and that sort of threw us into a few tough years. And that's when we came back to Marion, because both my parents grew up here. My mother held us together, and we righted the ship after about, she righted the ship after about 3 years, and everything was all right after that.
You love the law. When did that first start to creep into your life?
Not until college. As I told you earlier, when I first went to college, I was majoring in broadcasting. So
it's your second career, I believe.
Yeah, it's sort of the thing. I thought, well, if Scott Spears will do this in the future, maybe I could too.
Darn right.
But then I switched to social work, and then I went into pre-law, and I figured, you know, it's a good line of work, and it involves a lot of reading. I enjoyed reading, and I thought I might be able to being a good attorney, and that's what I interested me. But it wasn't until I was like a junior in college before I decided on that.
We always hear law school is difficult and passing the bar difficult. Mm-hmm. How was it for you?
It's law school's a grind. There's no doubt about it. Especially, I went to Ohio State Law School, which is has the highest standards in the state of Ohio, and it's very competitive to get in. So, you know, you had to study all the time, and basically that's what I did. It was I worked part-time, too, as a law clerk, which gave me a lot of practical experience, but you know, no social life to speak of for 3 years. It's that simple.
For people who always hear about it, the bar, what is the bar?
The bar, well, the bar exam.
Yeah.
Back when I did it, it was a 3-day test. Now it's 2.5 days, but it's very grueling. 2 days of the exam is a multi-state bar examination. So they give this pretty much around the country. Multiple choice tests. And boy, I really didn't really care for the questions there, because it was sort of like you're answering like, what's the second weakest legal theory? Well, you know, that can be a matter of opinion. But I wasn't real happy about that. And then you had 1 day of essays, where they would give you a question, you would write essays and stuff, and that was a lot easier for me and stuff, because I knew the answers and I could spell in things. But, you know, I got past it the first time, and then once you pass the bar, then you have your ticket. And then you just have to find work.
What was your career as an attorney like?
Well, I came first week of my third year of law school, last year of law school. Mike Piacentino, who was an attorney up here in Marion, he invited me up for an interview. I sent resumes to a lot of attorneys in Marion, Dayton, Columbus, even London, England, because I lived there for a while. And I got a bite from Mike, and he invited me up, and he and Gene Yazel, who shared the same building, had a different office. They interviewed me, and they liked me, and they extended the offer that first week of the last year of law school. So that was very nice, and I was thrilled to come home. My mom was thrilled that I was coming back, and it was a very good very good thing. It was great to be here.
The first time you represented somebody, what was it like?
Actually, the first one I had eventually ended up on death row.
Wow.
It's Joey Murphy, and he was a juvenile then, just a 15-year-old kid, and he had it was juvenile criminal damaging. He and his brother were throwing rocks at stop signs in Caledonia and such. And, you know, so that was my first case. And, you know, then you have the family history, and his family history was really poverty stricken even then. And then, of course, 9 years after that, he ended up doing that murder and stuff. And he was put on death row, and then Governor Kasich commuted his sentence simply because the background was so horrific, the kid never really stood a chance in the first place. Well, I think of him as a kid. He's an adult now, but so yeah, that was it.
When you represent somebody who's accused of murder, is it hard to do that? Do they tell you they didn't do it? They did do it? How does that work? Do you have to believe them?
No, you don't have to believe them, and you can tell them, hey, this doesn't add up. I mean, I never defended anybody who was charged with murder. I did do a lot of criminal defense work the first 4 years I was an attorney. You know what I do? I tell them, look, you got to tell me the story. You got to tell me the truth. You know, if I ask you questions, you got to give me the truth. If you give me the truth, I'll fight, you know, like there's no tomorrow. And I'll fight like there's no tomorrow, whatever you tell me. But if it turns out that you're not telling me the truth, I'm not going to feel bad when you get hammered on it.
When somebody commits a crime, because obviously you go to an attorney, either you've committed it or you're accused of committing it,
mm-hmm.
And they tell you honestly that they did do it, mm-hmm. is it hard to go argue for that person?
No, because there's a lot of variance as far as what happens as a result of that. And back when I started, you know, if you were charged with a felony, and that was the type of work I did back then, there was a decent chance you'd go to prison right off the bat. You know, it's not like today. And so, but there were possibilities that you could get probation and such. And that's what you would fight for in that type of thing. So, or if it's a thing where they had to go to prison, you fight for a lower prison sentence than the prosecutor's recommending, and you try and use your skills to persuade the prosecution and the judge why your client deserves a lesser sentence. And that's what you do. You just do the best you can. Persuasive skills.
As an attorney, is there a case that sticks out in your mind?
Well, yeah, there's a number of cases. I had a couple cases go to jury trial. Both cases, the people told me they didn't do it, and they were both felonies. Mm. So we took it to trial, and I, fortunately, I ended up winning both of them, you know, so the people, you know, went free on it. And I'll never forget the first one I did, and it was receiving stolen property or something. And we go through the trial, and the jury comes back, and jury returns a verdict of not guilty. And the guy, he turns to me, he says, "Wow, thank you. Thank you, you did a great job." I said, "Yeah, I didn't think I did too bad for my first trial." And he goes, "First trial?" So that was pretty good.
That's a good way to roll in there.
Yeah, yeah. That was funny. So, yeah, it was all right. So, it was good. I'll tell you, I have respect for defense attorneys especially because, you know, you have people's lives in your hands, you know, and if you have a bad day, they pay the price, you know, when they may not deserve it. So that was a lot of stress on me. You know, every time I took one of those to trial, I'd age a year, mm-hmm. you know, and I put in my best efforts and such, and fortunately it worked out those times. And it is. It's tough for, you know, and for the defense attorneys who have the horrendous cases, you know, that's very draining on them.
From that part of your career as an attorney, do you have any regrets?
No.
None?
No. That's no, great. I was doing my job, and I did it to the best of my ability. That's what I'm supposed to do.
1989, how did it come that you became a judge?
Well, how it happened was I was practicing as an attorney, and about 3 years into my practice, you know, I was watching Judge Rogers at Municipal Court, and I'm starting to think to myself, you know, I think I could do this job. You know, I think being a judge might be an interesting thing. Initially, I never thought about it. But then I said, well, maybe I'll be doing that. I majored in political science. I ended up majoring in political science. And so I knew how judges get selected and such. And so I just set the groundwork in 1982, became a member of the Central Committee of the Democratic Party and such, and helped out other people in the party, did my work and I stayed quiet. I didn't tell anybody I was interested in being judge. And I, you know, worked quietly for 6 years and waited to see if there'd be a vacancy that would happen. 6 years later, it did. And fortunately for me, there was still a Democrat as governor at that time, Richard Celeste. And the Central Committee's recommendation carried a lot of weight. And I got, it was three people who applied, and I got 90% of the Central Committee vote. So that was a strong thing. And governor ended up appointing me for the vacancy when Judge Rogers left to go to Common Pleas Court. And then I had to stand for election the following November, 10 months later. Ended up winning big. So it was good. And the rest is history.
You have a history of 30 years of winning big. What do you attribute that to?
You know, a couple things as I grew up here. I mean, it's my hometown after I was 8 years old. And my both sides of my family grew up here. You know, so you have connections there. This is not a type of county where there's a huge influx of people and things are changing like in Delaware County, for instance, all the new people have moved in there. So that's one plus. And I think my family had a good reputation, not wealthy, but, you know, we had a good reputation. I think part of it is I was active. You know, I like to play softball. I like to play basketball, you know, and things like that. Amateur radio, a lot of activities and stuff. So I sort of, people see me there and, you know, either they like me or they don't. I guess a lot of them like me. Probably the biggest thing for municipal court, how I got reelected there, is we were always one of the five busiest single judge courts in the entire state. And I'd see probably, honest to God, 10,000 people a year at that job. And the vast majority of them are local people. So they see me sitting as a judge. And either they like the way I'm doing it or the way I don't. You have the Tuesday morning, Tuesday afternoon cattle calls, you know, for all the traffic tickets. You'll have 70 people, 50 to 70 people in each session, and most of them are local. And they not only see what I do with their case, they see what I do with the other 50 cases. And they can get a pretty good feel for, you know, whether I'm a decent judge or maybe I'm power mad or something like that. And I guess most people like the way I operate it.
You know, it's interesting. I have read stories about judges running for office, and they run on the idea of this is how I'm going to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
So they already have a philosophy, it seems like, before they've ever heard a case.
Mm-hmm.
What's your philosophy?
Well, it's interesting you asked me that question, because for a number of years, I think 7 or 8 years, I have actually taught building your judicial philosophy and reputation.
this is a good territory there.
Oh, yeah. You've hit my wheel well. and that's what I talk to them. And it's the very first day, very first course they take of this week that they have to go through after they're elected judges. And you can build your own philosophy and your approaches, and I throw out fact situations and how would they handle this, and we get really good discussions going. And some judges have they have a preconceived idea, this is what I'm going to do, and that can be legitimate. They have their way they want to try and fix things and make things better, and they can approach that. You know, there may be downsides to it. If they walk in and they're so rigid that they don't listen to the particular cases and basically they disregard those that don't fit into their mold and force it to fold into their mold when it shouldn't, that's probably a bad thing. But you can have philosophy. I certainly had philosophies when I was going in. I wanted to make things more efficient and get the cases done. Now at municipal court, that's what you had to do. The caseload was so vast. That you had to get the cases done and move on, and I thought I'd be good at it, and I was. I cut down backlogs that were there, and I think people appreciate that.
In 2018, I think we all talk about the drug issue.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big, people run on it. People talk about it. It's what's on people's mind. And, you know, there's no tales out of school here because this has been printed. I've heard judges in other counties say, these judges are soft. If you come to my county and you're doing drugs, it's going to be bad news for you. You're going to end up... When that judge would hear a case, does it even matter then what the case is if you've already made that declaration and are elected on that?
Well, I guess you sort of open yourself up to the question of whether you're biased, but, you know, unless they show in this particular case that they are biased and stuff, they can stay on it. And, you know, and judges have a lot of leeway as far as things are going. I'll tell you, it's really sort of odd here in Marion County because, you know, you read the notes or whatever people make on social media or whatever, and, you know, they get the impression that we've been soft in Marion County, and we're not. You know, that's just a fact. We send people to prison at a much higher rate than the statewide average. Like 2016 or 2012 election, last one I was contested with, we were sending people at a rate 55% higher than the statewide average. You know, now it's not as high as one of the neighboring counties, but that neighboring county sends them at a rate 40% higher than the second highest county in the entire state. Matter of fact, that county sent, there was a certain class of people they called TCAP eligible in 2016, and they broke it down by county, and the one county next to us sent 99 people to prison, but Marion County, we sent 52. Now you compare it to Franklin County, 1.1 million, those 15 judges sent 115. Mm. So you take a look at that. I mean, we're sending them at least three times the rate they are in Franklin County.
Where do you think the misconception comes from?
Well, it's all relative. People don't know what the facts are in other counties. There's two counties that adjoin us that sent only one of these TCAP-eligible people to prison that border us. But you don't hear about that.
Yeah.
You know, and our rate was above every other surrounding county, the Marion County, other than that one county. So, you know, it's just not true. You know, we you know, the people who deserve to go to prison get sent to prison. And that's not just me. That's Judge Slagle as well.
This brings up an interesting point. What is a typical day as a judge in Marion like? What processes do you go through when you hear a case?
Well, it's a completely different thing. Like I say, I did 16 years at municipal court, and that's a completely different gig than common pleas because we do different kinds of cases. Municipal court, that's down at City Hall, that's designed to handle large numbers of relatively uncomplicated cases quickly, you know. And those, they're set in blocks, like that Tuesday cattle call, we call it. You know, I wouldn't see an attorney at all. It's just people with tickets or criminal citations coming up, guilty or not guilty. If they're saying guilty, or, you know, we do the sentence right there, it's done in 2 minutes. You know, that's how fast I moved, you know. But at common pleas, they're the more complex, longer cases, a lot less cases, but they're a lot more complex. And so it can be much more variable depending on what it is. Like today, I had a couple civil stalking protection order requests. There was a probation violation on a criminal case. There'll be a couple pretrials this afternoon. You know, I call them little, it's little day, you know, so comparatively, it's half hour.
When you look at this more complex world of common pleas, Judge, mm-hmm. is there something that sticks out in your mind from this period?
The remarkable variance of cases that you get in common pleas court. At municipal court, there were tons of similar type cases. DUIs, there's 500 of them, you know, in a year, you know, or speeds, you know, there might be thousands of them. Or evictions, you know, they're fairly consistent. Whereas here, there's just all sorts of cases. I have an administrative appeal from an administrative agency. You know, I get one of those every 2 or 3 years. or a medical malpractice case. Those are fairly rare. Injunction cases and land appropriation, you know, if they're they want to take your land for a highway or something, we deal with that. It's just all sorts of different things and a lot of different crimes.
I know this is a hard question to answer, but what do you base sentencing on?
You follow the law. They have guidelines that we're supposed to follow. Generally, at the lower level, less serious felonies, felony fourth degree, fifth degree felonies are what they call them. There's generally presumptions that they don't go to prison right off the bat. In some cases, it's very difficult to send them to prison, even if they don't want to follow through with probation these days. That didn't used to be the case when I started out as a judge, for that matter. And then it goes up, and there's some cases, there's presumptions of prison, and sometimes those are strange because you may have that one case, but the guy or lady may have had a perfectly crime-free life, you know, and there may have been something where the person snapped, you know, and so it can be awkward that way. Or the people, the victim, family may say, this person should not go to prison. You know, even if there's a presumption, you know, because they know the person. It's that, you know, he has a problem. He needs help with drugs or something like that. But no, he shouldn't go to prison. And believe it or not, we run into situations like that.
When, not in any particular case, but have you ever second-guessed yourself after the sentencing came down? You said you thought about it and said, boy, you know, I should have done that differently.
Yes.
What do you do when that happens?
I resolve to do better. You know, it was a close case. Yeah, and that's it. Sometimes you have very close cases as far as the resolve. Should he go to prison or should the person not go to prison and stuff? And, you know, there may be options. You know, it might be judicial release later on and stuff. You know, get him out fairly quickly and stuff. But, you know, law is not an exact science. It's not like math.
We had a conversation on our current event show not too long ago about white collar crime.
Mm-hmm.
These people, we always use Martha Stewart as the example, mm-hmm. because she was sent to prison, but she was never a danger to herself or to others.
Mm-hmm.
And to my knowledge, she didn't have a prior criminal background.
Mm-hmm.
Is somebody like that, does it do society any good to put them in prison and give them a felony charge?
It could be a deterrent for other people who'd be involved in, you know, doing whatever shady dealing they were doing in stock manipulation or whatever. You know, I mean, that's part of it. You know, when you're dealing with punishment, it's not just a matter of taking care of that particular person. It's to serve as a deterrent for other people to say, oh, maybe I shouldn't do that. And, you know, you take a look at what happened with the Great Recession and all the business shady dealings which helped trigger that, and nobody went to prison for that. Well, where's the deterrent?
Yeah.
You know, you get suspended for a couple of years, then you're able to trade again, you know, and yeah, you lose a lot of your reputation, which is not insignificant. But on the other hand, maybe some people ought to go to jail.
It's interesting, yesterday when we're taping this interview, it's live now, but we do rerun these things. So if you're hearing this in a rerun, we're taping it on Thursday, or playing it live on Thursday. School shooting yesterday, and on the front page of the paper today, there's a story about should people be allowed to have carry guns on Ohio State's campus. I believe Judge Slagle is...
Well, yes, he has that case.
He has that case. What do you make of that?
I really shouldn't comment about the case that's going on right now. And, you know, there's always been an issue on the Second Amendment and how broad is it, you know, and you have the question about, you know, what are appropriate regulations for firearms. That's a matter for public policy. You know, we basically, as judges, we take the law as they have it, you know, as they present it to us, and we apply it to the facts that are involved. It's a public policy decision as to what restrictions on guns there should be in this country or in this state. And that's where they fight it out. And that's all I can tell you, is that it's a public policy issue.
30 years, few people have this type of run continuous 30 years. 1989, you'll leave at the beginning of 2019. How have the people in Marion changed who come before you, and how have the cases changed?
I don't think the people have changed very much. You know, people of Marion, they're the people of Marion. That's who I grew up with. That's who I live with and interact with and such. I haven't seen any big difference. There hasn't been any sort of huge influx of people coming in from out of county. It's basically pretty much the same setup that it was as I grew up. That's one of the interesting things about this town. One of the things I love about, I guess I'll sidetrack off a little bit on this. You know, one of the things I love about Marion, there's no traffic jams. Yeah. Did you ever notice that?
That's true.
And you know why? It's the same population it was when I was growing up. It's around 35,000 in the city, about 65,000 in the county. And that saves you a hell of a lot, excuse my language, it saves you a lot of time during the day not being tied up in traffic like you are in Columbus. And I think that's a pretty neat thing. So sorry, I just went off on that track.
The cases. Do you see more?
Changes of cases? There's a lot more drug cases. There were very few drug cases when I first started out 30 years ago, and wasn't a tremendous number of drug cases when I started at Common Pleas in 2004. Things started to take off about 2008.
If people haven't changed, what has caused that change?
I think one of the major factors, from what I understand, countrywide, was medical community changing their approach towards pain medication and the administration of medical painkillers just exploded beginning about 1996. And as part of that, I think a lot of people, and I've seen that in a lot of the pre-sentence investigations, you know, Joe Blow working on roofs, and he fell and hurt his back or something, and he got addicted to the painkillers. I'll tell you, when I had my cancer surgery 5 years ago, you know, I was in the hospital for about 5 days, and they were giving me painkillers and stuff. I didn't want to take them because I'd just seen so many of these cases. And finally, my wife one of the nurses sat down with me and said, look, you've got to take these because that will help you. Because if you don't take them, it's going to hurt your getting better. And so I did, but boy, I was touchy on that. And as soon as I could stop taking them, I did, because that can be a bad way to get hooked on.
Is there a way to fix this? Do you see an end, or is it the way it is?
Well, 2012, I said, no, I don't see a light out of it. As far as, you know, everybody's happy and stuff, it's going to be a game of inches, I'm afraid. And, you know, the guy who ran against me, you know, tried to hit me on this and said, oh, he doesn't see any way there's out of it. I'm going to tell the truth. It's a very difficult situation. And, the way you stop it is people don't get hooked in the first place. But if they are, it's tough to get them out. That's why Judge Slagle's drug court, that's such a nice thing for people who really are having major problems, to try and get them to get out of it. And they spend a lot of time, they spend a lot of money and a lot of effort, and they have success stories sometimes. And that's great for those people and their families. That's a wonderful thing that Judge Slagle's doing. But, you know, it's so intractable, this problem, that, you know, they say even if you do a good drug court, it reduces recidivism, you know, further felonies later down the road, by 24%. You know, well, 24% is significant, but it's not super. You know, 76% are still going to cause problems. You know, and that's what most people, they don't want that. They want a problem where it's all taken care of. And that's just going to be very difficult to do, I think.
You talked about your cancer operation.
Yes.
tell us as much or a little. A lot of people go through it. Mm-hmm. How did you find out you had it, and how did you go through it?
Well, I'd been visiting my brother up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I was driving down to eat at Tony Paco's in Toledo on US 23 in Michigan. I was bored, Memorial Day weekend, and so I was just feeling my neck just because I'm bored. And driving down the road, and there I felt a lump there. I said, well, what's that, you know? And so I went into the doctor a few days after that, and they tried some different things, hoping that it wasn't cancer. But eventually they took me in for a biopsy, and it turned out it was cancer. So they told me, you know, it was a rare cancer, rare type of cancer, neck cancer. And it was a... it's going to be a tough haul. They thought I'd survive, but it would be a tough haul, and they were right.
You look good, though.
Oh, I'm feeling great.
You did survive.
Oh, yeah. Not only that, I was overweight then, you know, the surgery was all right. But, boy, the cancer, the treatment, man, that just about killed me. I lost 60 pounds, and, you know, I was down to high school weight by the time it was done. I've gained 20 back, but I'm not overweight anymore. So
there you go.
So that's a good thing. I'm trying to keep my, myself out. You know, the funny thing, though, you know, people still think I'm sick because I'm not as overweight like I used to be.
Oh, is that? Well, you know, honestly, somebody, when they heard you were retiring, they asked me, they said, well, is he ill?
Yeah.
Now, you can definitively say now.
No, it's not. It was so funny, you know, because first I told my wife, then I told my secretary. Third person I told Scott Schertzer, Mayor Marion, so he could tell the Democrats. I was going to tell the Republicans later that day. And he's just listening to me, you know. And then I get done, and he stops. And then he just looks real serious. He says, are you okay? Yeah. And I go, what? I go, oh, yeah, I'm fine.
You're
so, no, I'm fine, yeah.
We're all glad to hear that.
I'm 100%.
You're a Democrat.
Yes.
You've run as a Democrat.
Indeed.
We have had a lot of the gubernatorial candidates on. Mary Taylor's been with us, Dennis mm-hmm. Kucinich, mm-hmm. Richard Cordray. Connie Pillage dropped out yesterday.
Yes.
So our mayor is no longer in the running that I know of as for lieutenant governor. But do you have a preference, Rich Cordray, Dennis Kucinich, the people left on the Democratic side?
Under the Code of Judicial Conduct, I'm not allowed to endorse political candidates.
Is that right?
Yep.
I did. You can't endorse.
I cannot.
Cannot.
Endorse.
Cannot endorse.
Right.
You're not allowed to say you have a preference.
That's correct.
Okay. But you vote Democrat.
I do.
Okay. What do you make of politics now? It's so expensive, so mean. I mean, it seems to be an angry thing.
It is, and frankly, I have a lot of concerns about it, both locally and nationally. Locally, my concern is the decline of the Marion Star, simply because of economics. It's not like there are terrible people there. The one reporter, Sarah, I think she's a fine reporter from my interactions with her. I don't know the other person. But the, you know, she tries, but my Lord, it's just one reporter. You know, you look back, you know, 40 years ago, you look back 100 years ago, how many articles there were in the Marion Star. And now it's just very limited. And local people really don't have that many opportunities to learn what's going on. And that's sort of scary because most of the people are uninformed, really, and that's a problem. And I guess this radio station helps change that and such, but there's so many things you can do as far as entertainment, you know, like the Sirius radio or whatever it is, and a lot of people don't even listen to local news. So that's a problem. And then you're left at social media things, and it's terrible. You know, because anybody can give their opinion, no matter how uninformed it is. There have been a few times I've been cheap-shotted. I can't respond to it because it's a pending case, but there's very good reasons I did what I did, but they don't know that, and they just say, oh, he's slapping him on the wrists or something. You know, I always love that statement.
Well, being in the public eye for 30 years,
mm-hmm.
you can't respond,
mm-hmm.
but what's the worst thing somebody said about you? Something you really didn't like.
Oh, sometimes they say I'm corrupt, which is just wrong. It's not. You know, I'm an ordinary Joe, and I'm trying to do my best job, and that's it.
Can you brush that off, or is it hard to brush it off?
Well, it's hard to brush off, but, you know, I'm a big boy. I can live.
One thing I've noticed, you've only announced you're retiring a short time ago.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people running.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you can't endorse.
Mm-hmm.
Can you endorse? Well, I guess you can't during this election cycle. Will you endorse people when you are no longer a judge?
I have to come to that when I do. Maybe I would, but I'd have to be completely out of the judge thing. I wouldn't be visiting judge anymore, so that may be a while before I do that. Yeah, well, I could. I could see myself being, you know, I like the Democratic Party, always have been. I'm a fourth generation Democrat, actually, you know, I could see that, but I'd have to be completely out of the judicial business by then.
Were you surprised that in such a short period of time, so many people jumped in?
No.
No,
because this is it. As a practical matter, if you get elected the first time as a judge, you're probably in there, you know, for your career. As long as you don't make any big major mess-ups. And that's the way it is in Marion. So with an open spot, yeah, everybody's going to be running. Same thing with prosecutor. I mean, Ray Grogan was appointed, but he hasn't stood for election yet. And it's expected that there's going to be, and there is a contested race on the prosecutor's race. And I'm not at all surprised that there is a contested election to succeed me as Common Pleas judge.
In January of 2019, that's a ways off, 11 months.
Mm-hmm.
Will it be hard to walk away?
Don't know. I have feelings both ways. I've really been working constantly, and I started out poor, you know, so I've been working constantly for 40, it'll be 41 years. Since August of 1977, I've been continuously working, which is a good run. But I'm financially where I need to be. I can live comfortably for the rest of my life, and my wife can too. So I'm real happy about that. You know, I've accomplished my goals there. I think the way I am, I love applying my mind, and so I'll do different things. Things I'll do fun. From what I understand, from what people tell me, retirement is doing the things you like, but more of it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be doing more kayaking. I'm going to be doing more amateur radio. I've been a ham radio operator for 49 years. Absolutely love it. Going to travel. I love traveling. I did a lot of international traveling when I was a young man. And I want to do that again with my wife and see various countries I've been to before and go to places I haven't been.
What a popular judge, 30 years in Marion, few people who don't know who you are. What's something we don't know about you? You're a man of varied interests. Is there something we don't know?
No, I'm pretty transparent as far as what my interests are, and that is it. I mean, I like playing softball, senior softball. I'm pretty good at that sometimes. I'm a high draft choice, let's put it that way. Probably the international travel, because I haven't done much of that since I became judge. And well, since I had kids, really. I mean, that was the thing. Not the fact I was judge, but the fact I had kids that were growing up. But now that we're done with it, you know, I like to do that. But really, no, not.
Is, aside from having more time and more time for hobbies and interests, is there something you will be able to do as a retired, semi-retired person that you couldn't have done in the last 30 years, or even when were?
Yeah. Yeah, one thing that just popped up, the last few years I've been interested in tracing my family genealogy.
Ah.
And so I'm going to track the Finnegans, and I have. From the time they came over here, as a matter of fact, I was able to trace the original Finnegan who came over, Michael Finnegan's his name. And this last September, I actually went to the village where he came from. I was actually able to find the exact location that they lived, the exact spot. and I went there, and that was magic.
Everybody should do that.
Oh, it is? It is
fascinating.
And so I went into the bar there, and or the pub, and there was somebody down at the end of the bar, and we're talking, and I said, my ancestor came from here 170 years ago that month, as it turned out. And he says, well, what's your last name? And he goes, and I go, Finnegan? He goes, ah, Finnegan. Yeah, knew a Larry Finnegan. He's dead. Knew a Mary Finnegan. She's dead. Knew a Pat Finnegan. She's dead. Yeah, they're all dead. All the Finnegans are dead. I know that because I dig the graves here in the village.
So, that's a good payoff.
So there about 20 years too late for me to meet any of my distant ancestors there in Ireland. But it was. It was a very magic thing, and I'm hoping to do the same thing from my German ancestry. I know where they're from, and that's fun. It's fun tracking that.
That's a good story. That's a great story. In the 3 minutes we have left here, 30 years running campaigns, going to the courthouse, being a judge, riding in the parades, everything that goes along with it. Will you miss that part of it?
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, a contested race is tough. And I was a political science major. I know what to do. And what you do is you work hard. Even if you're an overwhelming favorite like I was 6 years ago, I ran hard anyway because that's the only way I know how. And but once you're in it, it's a full life. You know, you're meeting people, saying hi to them and stuff. And that's the thing I love about Marion. People say hi. People come up to me all the time and say, hey, how are you doing, Judge? And yeah. I have no idea who they are most of the time. But they say hi, and I say hi back. And that's a beautiful thing about this local community.
Not so much about endorsements, but is there something that you can think of right now that might pop in your head that you will want to talk about and give your opinion on when you can?
I think what I've done over the years is try to improve the judicial system. So I make suggestions to the legislature, and actually a number of my ideas have become law. And I want to continue doing that. Just make the system work better. I'm chairman of the Commission of Rules of Practice and Procedure to the Supreme Court. And they named me chairman. So I do that. And that's sort of a big thing. So
you're a young man. Will you ever run for anything again? Nope. Are you slamming the door shut?
I'm done.
Not going to do anymore.
Nope. I've done my gig for King and Country.
30 years. What, 100 years from now when we're all gone, what would you like to be said of your 30 years in this role?
Just that I was a good judge, that I did my job, and I did it right. That's what I want. What I want is it's not about me, you know. 3 weeks after I'm gone, people won't even talk about me there. And that's how it should be, to tell you the truth.
I don't know if that'll happen.
Well, it should. Let's put it that way. I did my job. I've moved on. Let the world go on.
I cannot think of a judge who has been as popular as you. When I invited you in, you've always been kind to me to come in. Everybody has a kind word. Even when I was saying I'm going to have Judge Finnegan on, Charlie Evers had his ham radio story this morning. You know, everybody's got a story. We had a gentleman who had served on a jury. That's a great legacy to have.
That is. It is. Well, they're good people. I like them. I love this place, and I just want to do my judge right, my job right as judge. And that's what it's about. If I'm doing that, I'm doing what my life's supposed to be at this time. And that makes me happy. I try to do what I'm supposed to do.
Judge William Finnegan leaving office next year. He's still got time left. He's still got 11 months left. But the announcement came last week that he will not seek re-election. Judge William Finnegan, we thank him so much for coming on. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Scott, for inviting me.
We'll be back in about 10 minutes.
Types to give now. Blood and platelet donations are being distributed to hospitals as fast as they come in. Help address a winter blood shortage so patients can continue to receive the life-saving treatments they need. Resolve to make a difference. Help